Welcome. I am so thrilled, to have you joining us today for a brand new deep dive.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
We are taking a massive, truly groundbreaking scientific paper from 2022 and pulling out the most mind-blowing insights just for you.
I mean, it really is a phenomenal topic.
It is. The paper we are looking at is titled The Anglo-Saxon Migration and the Formation of the Early English Gene Pool. Now, I know that sounds like a bit of a mouthful, but trust me, this is essentially a true crime historical mystery.
Exactly, yeah.
Only instead of using dusty old scrolls or, you know, biased chronicles written by monks with an agenda, we are using ancient DNA.
Right, which is just incredible.
Our mission today is to answer a question that has baffled historians for literally centuries. What actually happened in Britain after the mighty Roman Empire collapsed? Was it a violent, bloody invasion by marauding tribes?
Right.
Was it a peaceful cultural shift where people just started adopting new trends? Or was it something entirely different?
And to really understand the sheer scale of what this source material accomplishes, we have to look at how they got the data. I mean, the researchers didn't just look at a handful of skeletons and make some broad guesses.
No, not at all.
They analyzed genome-wide ancient DNA from 460 medieval Northwestern Europeans.
Wow.
Yeah. And that includes 278 individuals directly from early medieval England. And getting that DNA isn't easy.
Oh, I'm sure.
They often have to extract it from the Petrus bone, which is this incredibly dense little bone near the inner ear. It acts almost like a time capsule.
Just preserving it all.
Exactly, preserving genetic material for thousands of years. But they didn't look at this genetic data in a vacuum. They paired it alongside meticulous archaeological data, things like grave goods, burial placements, site geography.
So we are literally reading history through genetics, looking directly into the cells of the people who lived through this massive transition.
Precisely.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really appreciate the bombshell this DNA drops, we need to set the historical stage. I want you to imagine you are in Britain in the early 5th century. For roughly 400 years, this place has been a thriving Roman province. You've got Roman administration, a centralized military, Latin being spoken in the towns.
People are living in stone villas with underfloor central heating.
Yes, hypocausts. They are drinking imported wine, going to public bathhouses. And then around the year 410, the Roman Empire is in crisis and they pull their legions out.
They're gone.
The Roman administration just ends. And almost overnight, historically speaking, everything changes. The language transforms, those stone villas decay, and the buildings change to sunken feature buildings made of wood.
Yeah, the massive pottery industries collapse.
Right. The farming practices change completely. It's a total overhaul.
And that abrupt shift is what makes this period so fascinating. The traditional narrative to explain this massive change, a narrative that dates all the way back to 8th century writers like the English monk Bede, is something called the Adventus Saxonum.
The coming of the Saxons.
Right. The story goes that it was a massive sweeping invasion by Germanic tribes crossing the North Sea, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes.
The classic history book version.
Exactly. The long-held assumption was that they arrived with fire and sword and completely wiped out or drove away the local Romano-British population into the western fringes.
Like Wales and Cornwall.
Right. And for a very long time, that invasion narrative was just accepted as historical fact.
But then science and archaeology started to advance, right? The narrative started to shift in the modern era.
You've hit the nail on the head. As archaeology evolved, particularly around the 1960s, a major counter theory emerged. Many modern archaeologists and historians started to argue strongly against the idea of a mass migration or a total demographic wipeout of the locals.
Okay.
They proposed what we call an elite dominance model.
Elite dominance? What does that actually look like in practice?
Think of it like a corporate takeover.
Okay, I like that.
Imagine a massive older company being bought out by a smaller, aggressive tech startup. A small, highly mobile group of new executives arrives, takes over the top tiers of management, and suddenly all the existing local employees start wearing Patagonia vests and using new corporate buzzwords just to fit in with their new bosses.
That's a great analogy. So they just rebrand.
Exactly. In the historical version of this model, a small group of elite Germanic warriors took over the power structures of Britain. The vast majority of the local British population remained exactly where they were, but they simply adapted.
They started making different pottery, building wooden houses.
Right, and speaking a new language to align themselves with the new ruling class. So in this model, the actual genes of the population wouldn't change much at all. Only the culture would change.
But wait, that doesn't fully make sense.
This raises an important question. If this was just a small group of elites taking over, why did the language change so completely?
Yeah.
Because the transition to Old English left almost zero trace of Celtic or Latin influence behind in the everyday vocabulary.
Which is wild. It is. Usually, when a small elite takes over a large local population, the resulting language is a blend, a creole. But here, the linguistic slate was seemingly wiped clean. That glaring discrepancy has been the elephant in the room for decades.
And that is exactly where the ancient DNA kicks down the door.
It really does.
Because to figure out who was right, the invasion camp or the corporate takeover camp, the researchers looked at the genetic makeup of Britain before this medieval period. They looked at the Bronze and Iron Ages to get a baseline.
Right, a control group.
Exactly. And they specifically looked for a genetic signature they call CNE ancestry, which stands for Continental Northern European. Basically, this is the genetic fingerprint of places like modern-day northern Germany, Denmark, and the Netherlands.
The North Sea zone.
Right. So before the Middle Ages, what was the baseline? How much of this CNE ancestry was actually in Britain?
It was incredibly low. A microscopic 1% or less.
1%. Yeah, for thousands of years, the local population was overwhelmingly what the researchers classify as WBI Western British and Irish ancestry. It is a remarkably stable genetic picture.
So no hidden German ancestors hiding out in the Bronze Age.
Nope. The only slight fluctuation we see before the medieval period happens during the Roman occupation. The researchers found that CNE ancestry crept up to about an average of 15% during the Roman era.
Okay, 15% is a decent jump. Did a bunch of Germanic tribes sneak in during the Roman era?
It seems like a jump, but it's vital to note exactly where that DNA came from. Six of the seven Roman-era individuals driving that 15% statistic came from a single excavated site.
Oh, really? Which one?
A baroccum, which is modern-day York. A baroccum was a Roman colonia, meaning it was a high-ranking city with a massive legionary fortress.
Ah, so it's packed with the military.
Exactly. It was a bustling cosmopolitan hub drawing soldiers, mercenaries, and merchants from across the entire empire, including regions near the Germanic frontier.
So that 15% bump wasn't a broad demographic shift across Britain.
No, it was a highly localized Roman military and trade presence. It was the ancient equivalent of testing the DNA of a modern international airport and assuming the whole countryside looks the same.
That is such a good point. But here's where it gets really interesting. Once we cross into the early Middle Ages, after the Romans are gone and those cities empty out, we look at the DNA again. So what does the DNA do? Do we see a small bump representing a few elite warriors?
Far from it. That continental Northern European ancestry doesn't just bump up, it absolutely skyrockets.
Skyrocketing like how much?
In Eastern England, it reached an average of 76%.
76%.
We go from a baseline of 1% to 3/4 of the entire gene pool in certain regions. The sheer scale of that genetic replacement is breathtaking.
That means if you picked a random person in early medieval Eastern England, statistically, 3 out of their 4 grandparents were from the continent?
Yes.
That completely blows the elite dominance theory out of the water.
It absolutely does. And the precision the researchers achieved here is stunning. They use a sophisticated machine learning tool called Locator to trace this exploding DNA back to its exact geographical roots.
And where did it point?
It pointed directly to the continental North Sea zone. Mm-hmm. We're talking specifically about areas like Lower Saxony and Northern Germany, the Jutland Peninsula in Denmark, and the Netherlands.
The exact places Bede wrote about.
Exactly. Mm. The genetic profiles of the people buried in early medieval English cemeteries are a near-perfect match for the people buried in those continental regions during the exact same period.
That is just definitive proof.
And what's fascinating here is the Y chromosome data completely backs up this story of mass movement.
Okay, break that down for us.
Think of a haplogroup, like a genetic barcode that gets passed down directly from father to son, generation after generation.
Right.
Before this migration, British men overwhelmingly carried a specific local barcode known as R1BP312. But suddenly, early medieval England is flooded with entirely new continental barcodes, specifically lineages called I1M253 and R1AM420.
And how common were those new barcodes?
They didn't just trickle in. They came to represent at least 73% of the male lineages in the early medieval sample.
73% of the men.
Right. When you look at those numbers, the idea of a small corporate takeover by a few elites completely collapses. A small war band cannot alter the male lineages of an entire region by 73%. This was a mass migration of people, completely reshaping the demographic reality of the island.
It's just staggering to think about the logistics of that. We're talking about thousands of wooden ships crossing the notoriously rough North Sea, packed with people over decades and centuries.
It was a monumental human endeavor.
But, you know, looking at grand statistics like 76% or reading about genetic barcodes can sometimes obscure the actual lived human experience. What I love about this deep dive is how the researchers zoom in on individual cemeteries.
Yes, the localized data is incredible.
We can actually look at who was buried next to whom and what their DNA tells us about their families. There is one specific cemetery they analyzed, the Dover Buckland Cemetery, that provides just the most incredible snapshot. So what did the researchers find when they looked at the family trees buried there?
The Dover Buckland site is a perfect microcosm of this entire historical epoch. Because they sampled the graves so comprehensively, the researchers were actually able to reconstruct a multi-generational family tree using the ancient DNA.
Which is basically ancientancestry.com.
Basically, yeah. And it starts exactly how you might expect a migration story to start with an immigrant family. The first generation they identified in this family tree was 100% continental Northern European.
So they just got off the boat.
Right. They were unadmixed immigrants who had made that dangerous journey across the sea.
Okay, so generation one is purely immigrant. But then as we follow the family tree down into the soil, the story evolves, doesn't it?
It does. Move down the family tree, and we see a woman marry into this specific immigrant family. When they tested her DNA, it was 100% local.
No way.
Yeah, she had unadmixed Western British and Irish ancestry. She was a local Briton marrying into a newly arrived continental family.
Wow.
And the descendants of that union, their daughters, have mixed ancestry, moved down one more generation to the grandchildren, and you see individuals who are essentially a 50-50 split of local and immigrant DNA.
That is amazing.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this absolutely shatters another old, ugly hypothesis. For a long time, there was an idea that the Anglo-Saxon arrival resulted in an apartheid-like social structure, where the Germanic newcomers and the local Britons lived completely segregated lives, didn't intermarry, and were buried in separate places.
Right, that they just pushed the locals out or kept them totally isolated.
Exactly. But the Dover Buckland family tree proves the exact opposite. If you take away one thing from this deep dive, it is this. The history books told us this was a bloody, segregating military conquest.
Yeah.
The DNA proves it was actually a complex process of localized integration.
You have locals and immigrants living together, marrying each other, and being buried in the exact same family plot.
Exactly.
I really want you to imagine walking through one of these ancient cemeteries back when it was in use. It's quiet. There are freshly dug mounds, maybe some wooden markers that have long since rotted away. If we could look down into those graves as they were being closed, what would the items buried with the bodies, what archaeologists call grave goods, tell us about this newly integrated society?
The grave goods are so telling.
Because the researchers matched the DNA to the objects in the dirt, and the gender split they found is absolutely wild.
It is one of the most revealing parts of the entire study. Let's look at the women first. The data showed a significant correlation between a woman's ancestry and her grave goods. Women who possessed immigrant or CNE ancestry were significantly more likely to be buried with objects, especially prominent decorative brooches, than women with local WBI ancestry.
So the immigrant women get the fancy jewelry. What about the men?
Well, when we look at the men, that correlation vanishes completely. A man was just as likely to be buried with weapons, like a spear or a sax, which is a specific type of early medieval short sword, regardless whether he was of immigrant descent or local British descent.
Wait, so a local British guy could be buried as a heavily armed warrior, exactly like an immigrant guy.
Yeah.
But local women weren't getting the fancy brooches. What does this actually tell us about the people arriving on those boats?
It suggests a couple of profound things. First, it completely eliminates the Hollywood idea that this migration was just a bunch of burly male warriors arriving on longboats to conquer.
Right, the typical Viking-style raid mental image.
Exactly. If women of immigrant ancestry are holding unique, highly visible status markers like these brooches in death, it strongly implies that women were a major active part of the migration process itself. Entire families were moving looking for a new home, not just war bands.
That completely changes the mental picture of the era.
It really does. Secondly, it hints at the social dynamics of integration. It's highly plausible that social status and power were initially tied to the immigrant families. For a local woman, marrying into a CNE family like that local woman we saw at the Dover Buckland Cemetery might have been a path to integration and status, eventually adopting the cultural dress and the brooches of the newcomers.
And the men.
Meanwhile, the men, regardless of their genetic background, might have integrated through military service or shared agricultural labor, resulting in equal access to weapon burials.
That makes so much sense. And just when you think you have a neat, tidy rule, immigrant women get brooches, men get weapons regardless of background, the data throws you a curveball. The researchers are quick to point out these mind-bending exceptions that prove history is incredibly messy and never simple. For example, Grave 80 in Oakington.
Oh, this one is fascinating.
Here we have a man whose DNA says he is predominantly local British, but he is buried with immense outrageous wealth. He was interred under a barrow, a massive ancient burial mound, and buried with silver disc brooches, an entire cow, and a chatelaine.
Which is a decorative belt hook used to carry keys or small tools and was a massive symbol of household authority.
Right. This local man was clearly a prominent, high-status individual in a community otherwise heavily influenced by immigrants.
That's the crazy part. And we also see incredible complexity in gender expression through these grave goods.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about Grave 122.
Right. At a site called West Heslerton. The DNA confirmed this individual was a biological teenage boy. He was buried with a knife, which is a weapon traditionally associated with male burials.
Seems normal so far.
But he was also buried with an equal arm brooch and a string of beads. In the rigid categorizations of early archaeology, brooches and beads are strictly, unequivocally, female grave goods. Yet here they are, carefully placed with a biologically male teenager.
It just goes to show that even in the 5th century, teenagers were breaking fashion rules.
Yeah, they really were.
But seriously, it makes them feel so human.
Exactly. It forces us to reconsider our own modern assumptions. Gender, status, and identity in early medieval England were fluid and highly localized. It wasn't a monolith. It varied from town to town, family to family, and even person to person.
So what does this all mean? We've traced this massive wave of continental Northern European ancestry crashing onto the shores of Eastern England, hitting an average of 76% in the early Middle Ages.
Right.
But if you're listening to this and you know anything about modern genetics, the math doesn't add up. Because if you test the DNA of modern English people today, their CNE ancestry maxes out at around 47%.
Yeah, there's a huge drop off.
So we have a glaring mystery. If the region was 76% immigrant back then, where did the rest of it go? How did we drop from roughly 3/4 down to less than half?
This is the final brilliant plot twist uncovered by the researchers. When they modeled the DNA of modern English populations, the math simply didn't work if they only used the ancient British DNA and the early medieval North Sea DNA.
It just wouldn't balance.
Right. There was a huge missing genetic component dragging that percentage down. And when they expanded their models to look across Europe, they found a perfect match for the missing puzzle piece, Iron Age France.
Wait, France? So not the Angles and Saxons?
That's right. This French or broader Western European ancestry accounts for up to 43% of the modern English gene pool in places like East Anglia today.
43%?
Yeah, and the vital takeaway is the timing. Because the researchers didn't see this French DNA in large amounts during the early Middle Ages in Eastern England, it absolutely must have arrived after the initial Anglo-Saxon wave.
Okay, that makes sense.
You can literally look at a genetic map of Britain today and watch that French DNA fade as you move from the East Coast over to the West, a pattern geneticists call an East-to-West cline.
And do we have any clue how that French DNA got there? Was it another massive sudden invasion like the first one?
It appears to be a much more continuous process over many centuries. We actually see the very beginnings of this French-related ancestry in a few of the early medieval samples from southern coastal regions like Kent and Sussex.
Just right across the channel.
Exactly. Archaeologically, those specific areas have long been known to contain Frankish material culture items originating from the Frankish kingdoms across the English Channel. So while the North Sea migration was a massive, sudden demographic shock, it was followed by continuous pulses of immigration, trade, and gene flow from the south and west of Europe.
Oh, I see.
And of course, this culminates in major historical events like the Norman conquest of 1066.
Ah, 1066, William the Conqueror.
Exactly. But it wasn't just William and a few knights. The Norman conquest tied England culturally, politically, and economically to France for centuries.
Yeah.
You had continuous channel crossings, intermarrying nobility, merchants, and clergy moving back and forth.
A constant flow of people.
Right. All of that subsequent European integration slowly watered down that initial peak of Anglo-Saxon DNA, bringing that 76% down to the 47% we see in the modern English population today.
Wow. We have covered an epic journey today. We started in the chaotic fallout of the Roman Empire's collapse, picturing villas crumbling into wooden huts. We watched as a truly massive migration of entire families sailed across the North Sea, fundamentally replacing the genetic barcodes of the island.
It's an incredible story.
We zoomed in to look at the freshly dug graves of Dover Buckland, seeing local and immigrant families blending together in real time. We explored how the women wearing brooches and the men holding swords revealed the nuanced, sometimes rule-breaking reality of a new society. And finally, we uncovered the hidden French twist pulsing in the veins of modern Britain, brought over by centuries of cross-channel mingling.
And this journey is exactly why a study like this matters to you, the listener, today. It provides definitive biological proof that human history is entirely dynamic.
Absolutely.
The concept of a pure, localized, static population is a total myth. The genes of the ancient Britons, the North Sea migrants, and the later arrivals from France all mixed to create something entirely new. The data shows us that humanity is, and has always been, in a constant state of motion, of blending, and of reimagining society.
So true.
The borders we draw on maps are temporary, but the genetic legacy of our shared mobility is permanent.
I couldn't agree more. We've just seen how a few centuries of migration completely rewrote the genetic code of an entire island, creating the English gene pool out of an incredible blend of ancient Britons, North Sea migrants, and later French arrivals. Given the unprecedented scale of global mobility, air travel, and integration we have today, what will a DNA deep dive reveal about the genetic map of the world 1,000 years from now? Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. Keep asking questions, keep digging into the data, and we'll catch you next time.